This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at Donald Trump's efforts to insert white Christian nationalism into government activities.
This white Christian nationalism isn't Christianity, it's a heresy. These people are racist, homophobic, vicious, and they're trying to take over our government.
We're joined by returning guest, author, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Chris Hedges.
We discuss a range of topics, including the impact of America's new oligarchy and fascistic Trump regime.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Several recent developments in the United States highlight an increased emphasis on Christian nationalism in government policies. This raises concerns about the separation of church and state and its impact on daily life. This heretical form of Christianity is being forced on us. It's supermasculine, misogynist, nationalist, homophobic, white supremacist, and racist. It's Christian in name only. The religion of egalitarian Jesus, who preached the values of the Sermon on the Mount, is not their religion. Christian nationalists want to use the power of the state to impose their brand of Christianity. It's not the solidarity of humankind. In early 2025, Donald Trump created the White House Faith Office. It aims to strengthen partnerships between the federal government and faith-based organizations so they can compete for federal funding and collaborate on initiatives addressing social issues. The order underscores the administration's recognition of the significant role these groups play in community development. Also in early 2025, Trump created a task force to eliminate what he termed anti-Christian bias in the government. This initiative involves a review of federal agencies to identify policies perceived as discriminatory against Christians. The task force has the mandate to ensure that faith-based organizations receive equal treatment in government programs. Joining us today is Andrew Seidel, author and attorney who has defended the First Amendment for more than a decade, both in and out of court. Andrew has dedicated his career to challenging religious privilege and to battling Christian nationalism. Andrew, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Andrew, what is the significance of the White House Faith Office and its potential bearing on the separation of church and state?
I think there are some significant implications. First, this is not actually a new office. A precursor was created by President George W. Bush, and it was really created by Bush to funnel taxpayer money to churches and religious organizations that had supported him in his political campaigns to make him president, which, you know, that has two big warning flags. One, that you're talking about a violation of the Constitution, and two, you're talking about grift. And we know about this and what this office did because Bush's deputy director for that office was a man named David Kuo, who was an evangelical Christian, and he left the office disenchanted and actually wrote a tell-all book entitled Tempting Faith. And he says that this was not an office that was about charity, but was about rewarding political allies. He said, quote, "It couldn't have been clearer that the White House needed the faith-based initiative because it had the potential to successfully evangelize more voters than any other." And the office would hold events for embattled Republican candidates with faith leaders. Kuo mentions that in 19 out of 20 of those races that they focused on, their candidates won. He talks about how any non-Christian group that applied for this federal funding was immediately given a zero by the grant officers. So we're talking about an office with a history of being used, taking public money and that being used to compensate political supporters, specifically evangelical Christians. Now, under the Obama and Biden, that office had broader goals. It was not about just partnering and rewarding churches, but also neighborhood organizations. And now Trump has rewritten it again and kind of gone back to that original. He's renamed it just the Faith Office. He's wiped out all non-religious community kind of aspects from the title of the order, though the order itself may have a little bit more expansive language. But it really does seem like a way to reward his most fervent religious supporters, who we know are one of the strongest voting blocks for Trump. And so the other two problems then that you have, aside from the history of this office, is we're talking about giving government money, taxpayer money, to religious organizations. And that has been, by and large, unconstitutional throughout American history. Right? Thomas Jefferson said that it was sinful and tyrannical to tax citizens and then turn around and give that money to churches or religious orgs. So doing so violates the separation of church and state. And actually, back when Bush created that office, you saw all these lawsuits in the early 2000s. And group after group were successfully challenging the office in lawsuit after lawsuit, stopping millions of dollars from unconstitutionally flowing to state-sanctioned religion. And so what happened? Well, the Supreme Court stepped in and in 2007 said that taxpayers have no legal right to challenge any money spent by the executive branch. Even if those expenditures violate the Constitution, said you don't have standing to challenge it. So, I mean, to me, this office itself has some really big problems. But in particular, for a Trump White House and a Paula White being put in charge of this office, grift is the other big problem. Again, this office was created to reward political allies, and now we have a president who is a notorious grifter, right? Who has gotten in trouble with the law for that. And he has appointed a prosperity gospel preacher, Paula White. Paula White is an expert at enriching herself at the expense of her congregation to run this office. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I have zero confidence that an office designed for grift won't be abused by Trump and White for their own financial gain. So I have very, very serious concerns about this office and its implications for the separation of church and state.
Andrew, the formation of the task force to eliminate, quote, anti-Christian bias, close quote, is being hailed by some as a necessary step for protecting religious freedoms. What's your perspective on this task force, and what potential dangers do you see?
I think the dangers are pretty sizable. The narrative about anti-Christian bias or Christian persecution in America is not meant to cure a genuine ill. Right? This is a lie that is meant to justify legal favoritism for the right, you know, right in scare quotes here, kind of conservative Christian. Right, look at what the Supreme Court did in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Right, this was a case about a bakery, a business, a limited liability corporation, wanting to discriminate against a gay couple and claiming a religious freedom right to do so. And the Supreme Court ended up deciding that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission in that case showed anti-Christian animus to this bakery and decided in the bakery's favor. Look at what the Supreme Court did in the case Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. This was the coach that was imposing his prayers, his Christian prayers, on other people's children at the 50-yard line after football games. And the Supreme Court manufactured these facts about this being on his private time and that it's okay for him to do because he's just exercising his personal religion, never mind that he's actually doing it, imposing his religion on other people's kids. And look at what Trump said during the announcement of this order. I actually wrote about this for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Trump justifies this entire task force with two pieces of disinformation. The first is the myth of Christian persecution, and the second is a specific case that he mentions, the criminal conviction of Paula or Paulette Harlow. And Harlow's case is not an example of anti-Christian bias. It's an example of our justice system refusing to extend special treatment to Harlow simply because she's a Christian. In other words, it's precisely how the system is supposed to work. And because the system worked as it should, jailing a person who knowingly violated the law in an effort to further political goals that align with Trump's party, Trump pardoned her. So if you go back and listen to what Trump said when he was announcing this order, he said, quote, Paulette Harlow was sentenced to 2 years in prison for peacefully praying outside of a clinic. And if we look at what really happened, you can see what they mean when they're talking about anti-Christian bias and how it's nonsense, how they're really talking about Christian privilege. What Harlow actually did was help plan and execute a forceful blockade of a reproductive health clinic in Washington, D.C. in October 2020. So you have that that's during the run-up to the presidential election. And recall, this is when COVID cases have topped 9 million nationally. And the way they did this was one of Harlow's co-conspirators booked a sham appointment to the clinic. And then when they were given off access, Harlow and the others forced their way in. One of the co-conspirators shoves a nurse, severely injuring the nurse's ankle. And then in the court's words, a melee ensued. Harlow purposefully falls on the clinic manager, shoving the employee into a waiting room chair. So Harlow and these nine others blockaded the clinic doors using their body and furniture and ropes and locks and chains, which is something that Harlow advocated for during the planning meetings, according to the evidence. And then the group live streams this assault. And mind you, we're talking about an assault on a healthcare clinic where patients are exercising their most basic rights. And so Harlow and her group shut down the clinic for 2.5 hours. Again, because they live streamed it, there was plenty of evidence. There was no real doubt as to what was going on. They refused to cooperate with law enforcement officers. And Harlow actually told Fox News that she considered it an incredible honor. So in June of 2024, the court sentenced her to 24 months in prison. And so you have Trump saying Harlow's peacefully praying outside of a clinic, but it was not that. It was not peaceful. People were hurt. Patients were robbed of their constitutional rights for several hours. And even the praying that did happen, and the hymn singing that did happen after all the violence, you know, that may seem innocuous, but it's anything but when we recall that maskless singing transmitted a deadly virus at that time, and that this is a health clinic. And the church congregations that ignored those public health orders during COVID were among the worst that were hit. So this is not an example of the persecution of Christians. It's not an example of anti-Christian bias. It's a group of our system, or it's an example of our system treating a Christian just like it would treat anybody else. And that is what Trump objects to. And that is what he's seeking to change with this order. He is looking for legal favoritism for the right kind of conservative Christian. And everybody else gets the book thrown at them.
Well, Andrew, the melee at the health clinic that you just described reminds me of a variation of the storming of the Capitol on January 6. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of things like that in the year to come. But I want to talk about a 2024 Pew Research Center survey revealing that while a majority of Americans support the separation of church and state, a significant portion believes the Bible should have at least some influence on U.S. laws. I'm having trouble reconciling that.
You know, church-state separation is the only guarantee for true religious freedom. If you want religious freedom, you have to have church-state separation. And I think there are quite a few people who understand that, but not everyone. And I think what you are seeing, I think the contradiction that you've identified there, right, the dissonance that you're sensing, I think there's two things that are happening. So first, there is a lot of disinformation that is deliberately put out about the separation of church and state. For instance, one of the most popular talking points coming out of the Christian nationalist propaganda mills is this idea that the separation of church and state only applies to the state-running churches, right? It only prohibits the state from running a church, not the churches from trying to run the state. And I mean, that is fundamentally not true. That is one thing you will constantly hear if you ever talk about this stuff publicly, and certainly if you ever post about it online, for instance. Now, our founders, believe it or not, were reasonably competent writers. And when Thomas Jefferson chose that metaphor of a wall of separation between church and state, that's the phrase that he chose, the metaphor, he knew there was no such thing as a one-way wall. right? He knew that to keep one out of the other meant kept the same thing backwards. Vice versa was true as well, right? James Madison put it very nicely, I think. James Madison wrote that religion and government will both exist in greater purity the less they are mixed together. Right, so we know that they were trying to keep the church out of the state and the state out of the church. Right, they wanted a wall. And the other thing I think that you're seeing in the dissonance that you identified in that survey is there is disinformation out there about the Bible's influence on our law and the Constitution. And these two pieces of disinformation, these two threads, these two strains of disinformation really often go together. And that's the reason that I wrote The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, is to explore that disinformation and kind of debunk it, especially about the biblical influence on our Constitution. Now, I think the larger point is that there are people who support church-state separation based on that disinformation, right? So they think that it means, well, we're going to separate Judaism and Islam and Hinduism from the government, but this is a Christian nation, so that separation doesn't include Christianity, right? That separation doesn't apply to Christianity because the Bible so heavily influenced our Constitution. So I think there are people who fundamentally misunderstand it, and as a result of the disinformation that's out there. And then I think there are a lot of people who truly do support the separation of church and state, as that survey identifies, but they may not understand how important it is. And this is something that I've noticed a lot in this work. If you ask people, they'll genuinely agree, yeah, church-state separation is important, but they don't quite understand that it is the bedrock of liberty and equality. That when the government is prohibited from favoring one religion over another, that is the thing that allows us to come together as equals and build a stronger democracy. And this is something that Americans United for Separation of Church and State is working to show people every single day, working to show them how church-state separation connects to their everyday lives, right? That it protects our public schools. You know, I think back to the Kennedy case that I just mentioned, that it protects LGBTQ equality. Think back to the Masterpiece Cake Shop case we just mentioned, that it protects reproductive freedoms and so much more. And as we have seen, that separation, that wall of separation that Jefferson wrote about, as we've seen it eroded, we have seen those other rights rolled back too. Because again, that separation really is the bedrock of liberty and equality, and even, I think it's fair to say, our democracy.
Andrew, let's talk about Louisiana for a moment. In Louisiana, a law mandating the display of the Ten Commandments in public schools faced legal challenges. In November of 2024, a federal district court ruled that the law was unconstitutional, citing violations of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. Have there been any other suits like this?
Yes. So first of all, super proud of that lawsuit and that win. That is a case that Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the organization I work for, brought along with some of our allies. It's an excellent win. And it really is, you know, it's a prime example of the Christian nationalism that's on the march across this country. This is not just in Louisiana, you know, Texas to West Virginia, Florida to Idaho. So we've actually seen they've not yet developed into lawsuits because the bills and laws haven't advanced that far yet. But we've seen Ten Commandments bills fail in Texas and South Carolina and Oklahoma, and then more recently fail in Montana and a couple of the Dakotas. So this is something that is happening everywhere. And we are working at AU to battle and fight back every day. But it is a constant fight. And, you know, I think that the key thing about the Ten Commandments lawsuits is, yes, there have been previous fights that are almost identical to this, including at the Supreme Court. You know, more than 40 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in Stone versus Graham that displaying the Ten Commandments in public schools is unconstitutional. And we've even seen that a similar ruling in 2005, trying to get it up in the courthouses. This is well-trod territory. The reason that you're seeing all these bills proposed now is because of the slide, the heavy slide, the switch of our Supreme Court into essentially endorsing Christian nationalism over and over and over again, right, in case after case. And for instance, in that Kennedy versus Bremerton case. So you're seeing these legislators across the country emboldened and working to abuse the power of a public office to impose their personal religion on other people's kids. So Americans United is actually the group that's fighting for religious freedom of all of the public school families in Louisiana, because that Ten Commandments law is a transparent attempt to pressure public school students to convert to the state's preferred brand of Christianity. The sponsor of that law, back when it was a bill, HB 71, the lead sponsor was Rep. Dodie Horton. And she said, "I'm not concerned with the atheist. I'm not concerned with a Muslim. I'm concerned with our children and looking and seeing what God's law is." So this is the government playing favorites with religion, weighing in on a religious debate, and actually editing one version of a conservative Christian version of the Bible to come up with God's law, and then trying to force that upon children, upon a captive audience of impressionable school children. And Americans United, like our position is that students and families, not politicians, not public school officials, should get to decide if and when and how their children engage with religion. And that is precisely what the state of Louisiana is working to change. They want to impose this narrow version of the Ten Commandments of religion on everybody else's kids. I mean, the display that they want up begins, "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me." And we don't need to be turning our public schools into Sunday schools. What we need is a national recommitment to the separation of church and state. I really could not be more proud of that lawsuit. We had 9 families with children in the public schools. Those families come from a variety of religious and non-religious traditions. There are 14 parents, 16 kids. We're talking 30 plaintiffs altogether. There's a Unitarian Universalist minister. There's 3 Presbyterian ministers. There's 4 Jewish parents. There's 4 parents who identify as non-religious or atheist. Right, so this is a very diverse group. You have members of the clergy who are challenging this law. And so far, as you mentioned, we've been victorious, right? We won at the district court level, and it's currently where the case stands, for people who are curious. Right now, the Fifth Circuit has the case. There was a hearing, an oral argument on January 23rd. So we expect a decision any day now, and would really encourage people that want to support the lawsuit to visit AU.org and support Americans United for Separation of Church and State, because AU was created for moments like this to be the watchdog, to bring together religious and non-religious Americans in this very American fight.
And we so appreciate all the work that AU has done and that you have done. Andrew, in addition to inserting itself into the educational arena, can you think of another example where this administration has inserted itself into a sector that it really should not?
Oh, I think there are some clear examples of the Trump administration working to advance Christian nationalism. So first of all, they're doing quite a bit to advance Project 2025 and the goals of Project 2025. And Project 2025 was pure Christian nationalism. Some other clear examples for me, we've already talked about some, that the Faith Office is, I think, a pretty clear example of this administration advancing Christian nationalism. Another that people may not quite realize, they may not quite understand the dots connecting, is the attacks, from this administration that we are seeing on the very existence of trans people. And you can actually see this, there are glimmers of clarity where you can see this connection quite clearly, especially when you hear these politicians justify their attack. And the justifications are often biblical. So if you go back and look, remember Speaker Johnson, Mike Johnson, cited the book of Genesis after the House passed a bill banning trans people from women's sports. He said something like, it goes back to the first book, Genesis, male and females, he made them. And it's not right. So Johnson is, you know, theoretically not part of the administration, second in line for the presidency, you know, Speaker of the House. But it's not just Johnson. Trump's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a guy named Scott Turner, actually wrote, and he wrote this in a press release. He wrote that President Trump signed an executive order to restore biological truth to the federal government. This means recognizing that there are only two sexes, male and female. And then he added, it means getting government out of the way of what the Lord established from the beginning when he created man in his own image. Right? They believe that the attacks on the existence of trans people are realizing a biblical truth. They are justifying these attacks by pointing to the Bible. I think another place you can see some of this is immigration. It's motivated, a lot of their immigration moves are motivated by a desire that this country should reflect their white Christian nationalism, that it should be a white Christian nation. So race and religion are two of the big components of what they're doing when it comes to all of their immigration rules and regs. And you certainly could see that in the first Trump administration, where, for instance, both Jeff Sessions and Sarah Huckabee Sanders justified the child separation policy at the southern border by pointing to the Book of Romans. Right, so there's a solid history of them doing that. Certainly in the personnel, we can see this. Russ Vogt, be happy to dive in and talk about him if you want. But, you know, I mean, he is a self-professed Christian nationalist who now runs a – he has quite a bit of power in this administration. So I think there are other Christian nationalists who have been at it. Pete Hegseth, certainly, right? He's literally got it tattooed on his body, his Christian nationalism. So I think you're seeing it not reflected only in the policies, but also in the personnel. And as we all know from Project 2025, personnel is policy.
Yeah, Andrew, I'd like it if you would talk about those people. But before I ask you that, I want to remind our audience that this is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Heidi Boghossian. We're speaking with Andrew Seidel from the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Andrew, talk to us about these two people you just mentioned.
Russ Vogt is for me a fascinating and terrifying character. Senator Kennedy of Louisiana said that when Russ Vogt was confirmed, he likened him to Noah and said that everybody thought Noah was crazy until the floods came. So Vogt, for people who don't know, he was the president of the Center for Renewing America, which was a Christian nationalist outfit that was created after Trump won. According to documents, among that center's top issues were, quote, Christian nationalism. Vogt is one of the masterminds behind Project 2025. He wrote a big part of that playbook. Again, he is a self-described Christian nationalist. And he ran the Office of Management and Budget for the Trump administration the first time around. An undercover video that it rocketed around the internet last summer. Vogt is on tape, on video, assuring journalists who he thought the journalists were donors. He's assuring these journalists that Trump was still committed to the people and the policies of Project 2025, just that he had an issue with the branding. And that Vogt himself was going to, quote, rehabilitate Christian nationalism. On that same tape by those same reporters, they talked about how Vogt was running the secretive second phase of Project 2025, which was the implementation. What that means is Vogt was the one who was out there in the background working on the executive orders, working on the rulemaking and the regulation and all of these things that were going to be put into place that we've seen, that this kind of this fire hose of information about all these new policies, et cetera, that the Trump administration is putting in. Vogt was the one who was supposedly in the background doing all of that. So he is a zealot. He's an ideologue, a crusader for Christian nationalism. And this is the guy who said that we are living in a post-constitutional time. You know, and that's the Constitution that separates church and state. He, to me, is one of the scariest figures. And now he is in the administration And whether or not he was in charge of that secretive second phase of Project 2025, he's implementing it today. I think that that's quite clear, and is certainly taking advantage of the power and probably abusing the power to promote this Christian nationalist agenda. And, you know, I mean, Pete Hegseth, people are probably more familiar with him. If they followed the news at all, they probably saw that he has some Christian nationalist tattoos. I've had the displeasure of debating him a couple of times on Fox News and throughout my career. And he is a big proponent and big spouter of just Christian nationalist propaganda and talking points, including some of the things we've already talked about on this show, let alone all of the other considerable problems that he has against his name.
Andrew, we could literally talk to you for hours on this topic, and we are so glad that you've joined us. We just have a few minutes remaining. What advice do you have for listeners who may feel, you know, things have gotten out of control? Is there a way that the public can fight back against all of this?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. Yeah, yes, certainly. So, and first of all, I want people to understand they want you to feel overwhelmed and out of control. And most importantly, they want you to feel like this is inevitable. That is the point of what they are doing. Our brains are not advanced enough to keep up with the amount of news that is being generated now. And that is the point. Because when your brain gets hit with this much information, it shuts down as a defense mechanism. Right? So we talk about self-care a lot, but it is actually crucial to staying engaged and to staying hopeful about this fight. You cannot know everything that they are doing at all times. And if you do, you're going to burn out pretty fast. It is not biologically possible for your brain to take in that information and make sense of it. So take care of yourself. They are trying to overwhelm you so that what they want to do feels inevitable, but it is not. And in fact, we've seen that the courts are doing a little bit better job than even I would have predicted at holding some lines and at pushing back. Now, it's going to get to the Supreme Court. Those cases will get to the Supreme Court, and who knows? We'll see. But for right now, we know that they're doing a little bit better. We have seen people resisting across the country, showing up and getting engaged in other ways that don't involve doom scrolling, that don't involve just trying to read every news story, but actually mean showing up at, for instance, a town hall that is being held in their local community. And doing something like that is going to have a far bigger impact than 500 hours of doom scrolling, 1,000 hours of doom, 2,000 hours, a year, 2 years of doom scrolling, okay? So the other thing I would say is that there are a lot of organizations out there that are working to maintain the separation of church and state, to defend our democracy. Go out there and support them. We, like Americans United right now, needs your support now more than ever. And we are committed to getting our supporters and our donors more engaged. So we've got actions that they can take every month. We're featuring some of those actions both in our on our website, on our social media. And we've also got coming up in April in Washington, D.C., the Summit for Religious Freedom, which is right at the beginning of April. And if people are interested in that, they can go to thesrf.org. And this is going to be a really, really, really fantastic way to not only meet like-minded people who care about these issues, but build up that community and build up your activism skills. This is not just people talking at you. There are activism workshops. There are panels. You're going to learn a whole lot, and you're going to leave it feeling empowered, which is and not just feeling empowered, but leave it empowered to be able to help fight back against what we are facing right now.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. I know how busy you are these days, but we look forward to learning about more fight backs in the year to come.
pleasure, as always. Thank you so much for hosting me.
Thank you, Andrew. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last month, Elon Musk said something about the Trump election with which we could all agree. He said, "This was no ordinary victory. This was a fork in the road of human civilization," end quote. Now our democracy, however restricted by class and race, is in the process of being replaced by a super wealthy oligarchy. There are over 800 billionaires in the USA. They're now in the saddle. The Citizens United Supreme Court case of 2010 eased the process. Trump was elected with money from 10 people, pretty much. Elon Musk alone contributed $27 million. That is over $250 million from one man to another man. Biden himself, in his farewell address, warned of the takeover by an oligarchy. Echoing President Eisenhower's famous warning of a military-industrial complex, Biden talked about the, quote, tech-industrial complex. The second Trump administration will not be like the first. It won't be incoherent or chaotic. This has been guaranteed by the Heritage Foundation, who wrote a 920-page playbook for dismantling our democracy. The process has begun with Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords and calling for more drilling. Drill, baby, drill is his mantra. This is a race towards human extinction. On January 21st, he pulled out of the World Health Organization. The day he was sworn in, he pardoned some 1,500 people who had participated and even led the January 6th insurrection. This is a green light for fascist mobs who now feel they can get away with anything. The Democratic Party has greased the skids for this transition. It cannot be relied on for the defense of the American people. Biden and Harris, after accurately calling Trump a fascist in the last few weeks of the election period, then did an about-face, welcoming him to the White House, saying they would cooperate with him and praising his peaceful transition, a transition that Trump himself said that if he lost, he would not abide by. Today, we speak with Chris Hedges. His penetrating journalism has resulted in his being fired and deplatformed, starting from the New York Times, where he was the Middle East bureau chief and Pulitzer Prize winner, to the Real News Network, where he was fired because of his criticism of Biden and the Democratic Party. Chris Hedges is the author of many books and writes on Substack. Chris Hedges, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, in his farewell address 2 weeks ago, Biden warned of the dangers of an oligarchy ruling over us. But America's always had a ruling class. After all, George Washington, the father of our country, was the richest man in America in his time. Is rule by an oligarchy different?
Yes. So I looked at this election as really a contest between corporatists and oligarchs. And corporate capitalism is different from oligarchic capitalism. Corporate capitalism is about stability because it's about investments and often important trade deals. So investments are made in countries like China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Mexico, wherever. Oftentimes it takes a long time, significant amount of time to turn a profit because you're producing. So you want that decorum, you want that stability of an Obama or a Biden or, you know, even a Bush, as limited as Bush was. Oligarchic capital is another animal. Oligarchy wants chaos. It wants, as Steve Bannon says, to destroy the administrative state because it is a pure form of rentier capitalism. What it does, and this is what Amazon does and Google, it sets up toll booths. And you have to go through those toll booths. It extracts revenue in order for people to have access to goods and services. So I wrote a book called America, the Farewell Tour. It opens in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Scranton at the time was facing bankruptcy, and it was selling off or had sold off its sewer system, its parking authority, its electrical system, everything to private equity firms that jacked up the prices and, of course, deteriorated the services. So that's what you're seeing. And this, the oligarchs won in this election. And that's why you're seeing a rapid attempt to deconstruct all of the mechanisms in the state, including the Department of Education calls to privatize the Postal Service, because that's how oligarchs make money. So that's what the battle was, and that you were correct in your introduction to point out the power of oligarchs within this new administration.
I wonder, Chris, if you could explain the origins, if you will, of this American oligarchy that Biden spoke of. Where does it come from? How long has it been around? How has it developed? What are its principal origins?
Well, that's one of the ironies, because it's essentially unfettered, unregulated corporate power that created the oligarchic class and triggered this war within capitalism. So, and slashing the tax codes, which was a bipartisan effort. So you had the wealthiest among us, the billionaire class, paid less and less in terms of taxes. They were able to create monopolies like the digital platform monopolies. They were able to amass, individuals were able to amass tremendous amounts of wealth like Musk, like Bezos, and others. And their interest conflicted with the corporatists. So yes, oligarchs have always been with us, but it's been a long time since oligarchs have essentially run the country. They always had outsized influence given their wealth and power. But now we're living under a pure oligarchy. And these people are working very hard to dismantle all of civic society. Everything is to become privatized. And they want instability, because the more instability, the more people have to pay for services, including security. So everything becomes a form of extraction. Everything becomes predatory.
Chris, please talk about the destruction of our American form of government. Bernie Sanders, in a recent WBAI interview, stated that the billionaires have taken over the media, the political process through huge donations, and the government. Billionaires like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, are they utilizing Trump to effect a restructuring of American society?
Yes. I mean, let's not let the Democrats get a pass. The Democrats have been full partners in this deconstruction of American society. Programs of austerity, deindustrialization under NAFTA was carried out by the Clinton administration, ripping down the firewalls between investment and commercial banks with revoking Glass-Steagall was a Clinton project. The destruction of our system of welfare, and 70% of the recipients under the old welfare system were children, was a Democratic project. The militarization of police, the huge expansion of our carceral system, that was all it was a bipartisan, but it was led by the Democrats. So the Democrats are complicit in all of this, but the Democrats remain primarily a creature of corporate America rather than oligarchic America. So the deterioration within the American democracy was certainly carried out by both parties, and that seizure of power by the billionaire class and by corporations, so that you've deformed all institutions, and you mentioned the media correctly. It's a very important point that Ralph Nader makes about how 4 decades ago, the media used to report on the grassroots organizations, unions, civic organizations, many of which Ralph founded and led to carry out environmental reforms and worker safety reforms. And then, because they began to cater increasingly to their advertisers, they erased coverage. And that crippled those movements. And you've seen, especially with the rise of the internet, constriction of media entities like the New York Times. Their coverage on Gaza has been awful. It's been horrendous, including banning reporters from using words like, refugees and this kind of stuff, Palestine itself, in an internal memo that was leaked to The Intercept. So all of the institutions that once protected and safeguarded democracy have become captive to corporate power, including, of course, universities. So you have these, in a coordinated effort, these universities have shut down free speech and dissent on college campuses from coast to coast to placate their billionaire donors and turn them into academic gulags. And that is, again, another projection of oligarchic and corporate power.
You know, Chris, at the end of the recent election cycle, Kamala Harris and others, other Democrats, referred to Trump as a fascist. But now they seem to have stopped this. Trump was welcomed into the White House. Biden said in his farewell address, quote, "I wish the incoming administration success," close quote. Does this not scare you? I mean, can we ever, and certainly now, rely on the Democrats to protect us from the fascistic, authoritarian rule that Trump is already demonstrating?
No, the Democrats, I think, are kind of a dead party, and they fused with the establishment wing of the Republican Party. That's why Harris was touting her endorsement by Dick Cheney, a war criminal who left office with a 13% approval rating. I mean, they're completely tone deaf, completely out of touch. She led a vapid, celebrity-filled, issueless campaign, and the Democrats, in their postmortems, continue to show that they're completely unplugged from the reality of most Americans. It's all about branding, or we should have done this, or Biden should have left earlier, without addressing the most crucial dislocation of the American working class, 30 million Americans in mass layoffs since 1996, which the Democrats were responsible for. So not only have they refusing to address the fundamental problem that has given rise to our form of American fascism. So the Democratic Party not only has failed to recognize the problem, but they've failed to address their own culpability in an attempt to rectify it.
Chris, as a consequence of the Israeli genocide perpetrated against the Palestinians, that body of international law, which had been created, crafted after World War II to prevent genocides like that in Gaza, it's been trashed, really, hasn't it, by Israel and the U.S.?
Yes, but, you know, that fealty to humanitarian and international law is more honored in the breach than the observance. Our projects in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, were no less savage than what is happening in Gaza. Certainly, to a degree, Gaza is smaller, and the saturation bombing is unlike anything we've probably seen since the destruction of Dresden or Hamburg. But we violated just the invasion itself of Iraq. It was a violation of international law. Preemptive war is a crime under post-Nuremberg laws. But I think the other issue is that we in the West have never really understood our long capacity for genocide, whether that's the German slaughter of the Herero, the Armenian genocide, the Bengal famine of 1943 that took 3 million lives, the dropping of nuclear bombs on Hiroshima or Nagasaki, all of these genocides, which were integral to understanding Western imperialism and Western colonialism, have either been minimized or whitewashed by Western politicians and historians, but they're integral to Western culture and are as integral to Western culture and Western imperialism as the Nazi Holocaust, because they all emanate from the same machine, the machine that's killing the Palestinians. And that was something that the global South, countries like South Africa, understood and understand, but we don't. So, yes, I think the difference is now there's no pretense, because you saw an active effort by countries such as the United States to shut down the clamor by the vast majority of nations to impose the rule of law and to halt the genocide. And I think that what it is that the visage has kind of been stripped away. And that presages a very dangerous shift in global relations, especially with the climate crisis, mass migrations, the rise of failed states. I think many people in the global South probably correctly feel that as the world breaks down, this genocidal machine that we see in Gaza will become more and more familiar across the globe.
I just want to remind our listeners that this is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder, and we're speaking with Chris Hedges, our returning guest. Chris, please talk about the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. How do you view it?
Well, I covered the Middle East for 7 years. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. And Israel has a pattern that it always negotiates, that whether that's Camp David, Oslo, or any of the ceasefire agreements, it negotiates in phases. And its first phase, it will give it what it wants. And then it fails habitually to implement the subsequent phases, and certainly any phase that would lead to a just and equitable peace. And I suspect that's what we're seeing. I don't expect it to hold over the long term. Indeed, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has already said that he feels that he has every right to continue the war or the genocide. So, the Netanyahu government has already reneged on the principal agreement by saying that it won't withdraw from the Philadelphia corridor. This is the 8-mile strip of land that separates Gaza from Egypt. I think that it will break down. I think that we're already seeing this very cynical policy of, because Gaza's pretty effectively been destroyed, 1.9 million Palestinians are homeless, and those that, with the ceasefire have tried to return to where they lived have found mounds of rubble. There's no sanitation. Gaza's a wasteland of 40 million tons of rubble and debris. The UN has estimated, UNRWA has estimated that it will take 15 years to clear the rubble, which Israel is not about to permit. And of course, the Knesset on last Thursday enacted prohibition from UNRWA from conducting any activities within Israel's borders and makes it illegal for any Israeli official to have contact with UNRWA. This will accelerate the famine and malnutrition. You have numerous diseases. There's no clean water. So hepatitis A is rampant, respiratory ailments, scabies, and there's a lot of food poisoning from rancid food. There's no medical services. So you have 90% of the population living in makeshift tents in the open air or under these slabs of concrete because 9 in 10 homes have been destroyed. I think Israel's policy is clear. It will continue to orchestrate this humanitarian crisis. And then I think that we will see a resumption of armed attacks against the Palestinians. And the goal is essentially to offer the Palestinians of exile or death. And that's the plan, and the United States will back it, and that doesn't really matter whether it's Biden or Trump. They both have backed the genocide.
Chris, you wrote, among your books, you wrote a book documenting the collapse of liberals in the face of the growing neo-fascism in our country. And at a prayer meeting recently, as has been well reported now, of course, attended by President Trump on the day after the inauguration, we had an Episcopal Reverend, Marianne Budd, in a gentle and tactful way, looking directly at Trump and simply asking him to show some mercy to gay and transgendered people and immigrants who find themselves without proper papers and such. Trump responded a day later, though, that she was stupid, boring, a member of the hard left, he claims, and a hater. Do you think this presages a wider resistance to Trump or not?
Well, she didn't mention the genocide at all, number one. And she essentially pleaded with Trump to show mercy. That's pretty different from the great Old Testament prophets that thundered against injustice and the abuse of power. So I'm not quite as forgiving especially because she did not raise the genocide. But of course, Trump is very thin-skinned, and even that provoked abuse towards her. But I didn't look at her words as particularly prophetic or powerful or willing to condemn the malignancy of U.S. Complicity in genocide. That, for me, is the most important moment of our age.
Chris, I truly understand what you're talking about. So what can be done to resist and fight back?
I think we have to step outside the political system, and we have to resort to all of those mechanisms that disrupt the machinery of power. Civil disobedience, strikes are key, mass mobilization. I hope that at this point people are not going to put their faith in the Democratic Party as a viable mechanism against the rise of an American fascism, which is real. I mean, in that sense, the statements by the Democrats are not wrong. We have seen this, and you pointed it out in your introduction, the kind of turbocharged effort to dismantle bureaucracies and laws and anything that stands between the predatory power of the oligarchic class, or in any way curbs the predatory power of the oligarchic class. Of course, ideologically, the Trump administration is embracing even more fervently than they did figures like Mike Huckabee and others, the fascism of the Christian right, which becomes the ideological veneer for this pillage. So I think we have to regain the kind of militancy that saved us from fascism in the 1930s, or go back to the eve of World War I. That becomes a direct confrontation with the system itself and the abandonment of the belief that internally the system can reform itself.
Chris Hedges, how can our listeners follow your work?
It's on the genocide. It's called A Genocide Foretold, and it essentially looks at the antecedents for the genocide. I was also in the West Bank this summer, and then what it looks like on the ground. I wasn't in Gaza, but I was in the West Bank.
Well, we hope that you'll come back on Law and Disorder so we can talk about your book, Chris. And Jim and I thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.